Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Today, we're sharing two great stories with you. They are both very different. I'm going to tell you who's coming up in the second half hour of today's show, and that is Linda Krill. At the age of 57, this former Fortune 100 executive changed out of her Halston designer dresses and, for the first time in her life, donned leather pants, jumped on a Harley, and rode 2,500 miles down the Pacific coast. It was, as you can imagine, a life-changing journey, and she writes about that in Blind Curves. And as I said, she comes up in the second half of today's show. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome back author, journalist, screenwriter James McManus, who, in his own words, became somewhat obsessed with the French poet Charles Baudelaire. Toward the end of his life, Baudelaire said, "I have only had two responsibilities in my life, to my art and to my Black Venus." And we're going to learn more about who or what Black Venus was in just a moment. Let me tell you a little bit about James. James McManus is the managing director of the Times Literary Supplement and the executive director of News International. His first book, Ocean Devil, was made into a film starring Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. He's also the author of the novel The Language of the Sea, and James joined us a couple of years ago to talk about that book. That was a great book, and this book, too, is great. It's called Black Venus. James McManus, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is a novel, but with a difference. It's actually based on a real person. It's based on the great French poet Charles Baudelaire. It's about the illicit love affair that revolutionized modern poetry. So let's start with how you became fascinated or obsessed, in your own words, with Charles Baudelaire and how that led to you writing a book.
Well, I have to thank my old French teacher at school far too many years ago for me to mention. But there I was, a 16-year-old, fast asleep in the classroom with most of my schoolmates. And this wonderful man, Geoffrey Shepherd, not only introduced us to Charles Baudelaire, but infused us with the power of his poetry and the central mystery about Baudelaire's life, which was his long affair with what he called, the woman he called his Black Venus, a woman called Jeanne Duval. And it was that mystery, that sort of secret, that I really wished to examine and, if you like, get to the root of in this book, and that's why I wrote it.
And why write a novel? Why not write, a biography of him?
Well, we know a great deal about Charles Baudelaire. He lived in mid-19th century Paris. He was famous in his time, and indeed he was damned in his time as a poet who produced obscene poetry. But we know very little about Jeanne Duval. She was an exotic beauty from the Caribbean. She was a Creole lady, a voluptuous lady. But we don't know very much more about her relationship with Baudelaire than the fact that she inspired this incredible poetry in Les Fleurs du Mal, poetry which is widely regarded as the greatest French poetry in that language, and the first modern poetry in any language.
Mm-hmm. And that work was, as you said, at the time considered, I think it was like 1857, it was banned in Paris. They didn't lift the ban until 1949, like 92 years later.
Yes, they banned six poems that were deemed to be obscene, and only in 1949 did they lift that ban. I have to say that if you look at those poems now and read them, they are, frankly, erotic. And given the fact that we've moved on, you can understand the shock, the sheer shock they had in Parisian society of the mid-19th century. So Baudelaire was damned by his contemporaries, but so was Jeanne Duval. I mean, literary historians have damned her as a slut, a wanton, a drug addict, a woman who introduced Baudelaire to opium, who betrayed him with his friends. And I've never believed that that can really be quite true, that there must have been something else about her to both sustain the relationship with this contrarian character and inspire this astonishing poetry. And she did inspire it, as you've said in your introduction.
Yeah, so what did you come away with? You went into this project thinking she couldn't possibly have been that bad. When you came away from the project, did your feelings change about her at all?
Absolutely. I mean, I think Jean Duval has been very ill-treated by history, and may I say, by largely male historians and literary critics. She was a much cleverer woman than she's been given credit for. She understood that Baudelaire's sensual appetite, if you like, and his creative genius lay in the years of paradise, as the poet called them, when he was a young boy alone with his mother, living alone with his mother in Paris. And Baudelaire's mother had a huge impact on him. I mean, he adored her. His father had died at the age of when he was five. And for 2 years, mother and son did everything together. They walked the streets of Paris. They went out in the evening to the opera. She would not leave him behind. And Baudelaire's mother was a very well-dressed lady, a very refined lady with jewels and fine clothes and perfume and ribbons in her hair. And all that made a huge impression on Baudelaire, and you can see it in his poetry. And Jean Duval understood that, because for all his life, Baudelaire was trying to recreate what he called those years of paradise, and she helped him do it. So that, in that way, she gave him some sort of peace and contentment.
Right. He said that he wasn't interested in the romanticism of the romantic period. He kind of dished on nature, if you will, and the goodness of humanity. He wanted to focus, and you talk about this in the book too, that he wanted to focus on the struggle between goodness and evil. He wanted to write about sobriety and drunkenness, between chastity and lust, love and loneliness, you write. Talk to us a little bit about his actual work, if you would.
Well, fine, but first let me just say that Baudelaire throughout his life was devoured by despair. He was the victim of almost incurable melancholia. And as he looked around the world, he said that he saw universal failure, his own weaknesses, and that of humanity in general. And what drove him to become this great poet was the fact that he sought redemption from the squalor of his own life, and it was pretty squalid at times, in the pursuit of beauty. And for Baudelaire, beauty was the promise of happiness, and this is what we find in his work. He tried to create beauty, but he always said that we could redeem ourselves, we as sort of the common clay of mankind, through the creation of beauty, be it in poetry, be it in architecture, be it... And he found beauty in the back streets of Paris. He could find beauty among the beggars and the whores, right, with whom he consorted. That was his sort of genius, if you like.
Right, right. You also write in the book that he said, and I'm going to quote, "An artist can have no political conviction. His art is his revolution." Is that... are those your words, those his words?
Those are his words. I mean, I've slightly changed them, but that was very much his view. As I say, Baudelaire was a very contradictory character. He disliked the French monarchy, and indeed joined the mob on the barricades in 1848 to try and overthrow the monarch. But he equally despised the mob and didn't see much value in them. He would delight in the company of high society ladies, and yet, as I've said, he would trawl the bars and brothels of the Left Bank by night. So he was a very contrarian character. Politics didn't really mean anything to him, and although at the end of the life he turned to religion as a means of finding peace, he really devoted himself to the pursuit of beauty, and that was his big sort of mission in life.
Right. Very full of contrarianisms there.
I know.
I was reading about him on the internet, and I read that he called Edgar Allan Poe his twin soul. So there's another side, you know, of his darkness there too.
Absolutely. I mean, Baudelaire introduced Edgar Allan Poe to a European audience, not just a French audience. Baudelaire spoke excellent English, and he translated most of the works of Edgar Allan Poe into French, and they were a huge success. And once they'd become a success in France, they became a success throughout Europe. So he was much more than just a poet. He was a very modern thinker in terms of art. For instance, he saw the Impressionists coming and was a great friend of Manet. And that, I think, shows you what a kind of a very broad-based character he was, despite his pessimism. But I just want to make a point about this book. This book really is a story of a love affair. Mm-hmm. And it's a love affair that is one that's mystified literary historians for over a century. And I just hope that that people who read it can understand a little bit more about the woman who lay at the heart of this affair and who certainly wasn't the sort of the devil incarnate that she's been portrayed.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, James, I want to ask you how she did inspire him, how and why she was his muse. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is James McManus, and he's written a really great story called Black Venus, based on the relationship, as he said, between Charles Baudelaire and Jean Duval. We'll be right back. Please do stay with us. Then I splatter my wisdom in a design. I leave time suspended in great gravity's law. Metaphors till the world ain't spinning no more. And from there I put sounds to hear, no order man. Show the brand something yo will compare to Baudelaire. Something yo will compare to Baudelaire. Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no, LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Eric Maisel shares 9 ways to achieving your artistic goals. Maisel helps thousands of people follow their creative path and has written more than 40 books from psychology to making your creative mark. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. And check out conversationslive.net for more than 200 podcasts.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Open your ears, open your heart, open your mind. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is joining us. He joined us a couple of years ago about his last book. We're talking today about a great new book that he's written. He is author, screenwriter, and journalist James McManus. The book is a novel called Black Venus, and it's based on the love affair between Charles Baudelaire and Jean Duval, which was highly criticized back in the 1800s. So talk to us a little bit, James, about how this woman, who was so vilified back in the 1800s, became the muse of somebody who's become known as one of the greatest French poets.
Right. Well, let's start at the beginning. Baudelaire was 21 years old and a fairly wealthy young man when he first saw Jean Duval performing at the bottom end of the Champs-Élysées, which was then being constructed, this is 1842, in a little tawdry cabaret. And she was singing, he saw her, it was like a lightning strike. And the next day, a large bunch of flowers arrived at the stage door, and he moved her that very same day into an expensive apartment he had on the Île Saint-Louis. And for 20 years, these two stayed together in a very punishing, ruinous, but highly creative relationship. And your question is, how and why? First of all, Jeanne Duvall was a very attractive lady. She was exotic, she was voluptuous, she was possessed of a very full bosom. And that meant a lot to Baudelaire because it took him straight back to his mother. And his mother, when he was a young boy, would kiss him goodnight and envelop him in the mammary warmth of her capacious figure. And he remembered that. And so the attraction was physical to start with. Why it lasted so long, then we have to dig into the secrets that she unlocked in him and how she realized that the source of his creative genius lay in those childhood years. And she flaunted herself in front of him with the jewelry, with the perfume, with the dresses, the long dresses, that took him back to his mother. Now, their relationship was highly physical, and she satisfied him in a way that might be deemed quite unusual these days, and I don't want to be too indiscreet about this, but Baudelaire was a great voyeur. That was how he got his pleasures, and she somehow managed to work around that and in a way that completely seduced him. And it comes out very, very strongly in his poetry. But the other point about Duval is that she mingled with his friends. They lived together. She was a great party-going, opium-loving, and drugs were very popular and common in Paris at that period, woman. And opium was the drug of choice. And she and Baudelaire took opium in liquid form as laudanum in every drink they drank. And they drank a lot of wine. So she was a sort of party companion to him, a sexual companion to him, and an artistic companion to him as well. And those three things kept them together, as I say, for 20 years.
Right. A lot of great artists, you know, I think, like Burton and Taylor spring to mind. And
Yes, indeed.
You know, there are many great artists who go through that. Do you think that's just the nature of the business, the nature of the gene?
I don't know about that, but I do know that Baudelaire was as obsessed with Jeanne Duvall as Burton was with Taylor. That is for sure.
Mm-hmm. So when we talked last time, you talked about one of the most important things as an author, as a writer, is to get the characters right. The story, any story has to have credible characters. We have to like them or dislike them. We have to feel something about them. Given that these were real characters that you're writing about in fiction form, how did you approach that, James?
Well, Baudelaire I had known, as I've said earlier, since almost my school days. And I've read a great deal about him. He's become almost a sort of character in my life. And as I've said, we know a lot about Charles Baudelaire and his life. The real test was to try and create a credible character around a woman, Jeanne Duvall, the Black Venus of this book on Baudelaire's life, who has been just dismissed as a slut, and no more by almost everybody.
Right.
And yet one should remember that Baudelaire never judged Jeanne Duvall. He always forgave her. And that's what I found so interesting. And as you said, at the end of his life, he paid a great tribute to her.
Right. I mean, on the internet, too, they say over and again, she was illiterate, but that actually wasn't true, according to you.
No, she wasn't illiterate in the sense, she was not great at writing, but she certainly read his poetry. She understood what she was doing, how she was helping, how she was enthusing Baudelaire. She knew that perfectly well. And the point about Les Fleurs du Mal is that the inner cycle of poems, the sensual poems, are all about her. And even though Baudelaire wrote poems in that book which refer to other women, he could not, in my view, and most people share this view, have written any of that poetry without her.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about that woman that sparked in him his genius.
Right. And he called her his Black Venus. How did that name come about?
Well, in those days, Jeanne Duvall was a rarity in Paris. She was a Creole. She was not particularly dark-skinned, but very much mixed race. And that was unusual in Paris in the 1840s and 50s. So the term black was just sort of applied to it. Actually, she was very light-skinned. And when one looks at paintings of her by Manet, for instance, you would hardly say that she was mixed race at all. And she always resented that. She knew that's what he called her, but she resented that. And one can see why.
Right. It sounds as though you have somewhat of an affinity for her after doing all this research. Do you feel that?
I do, in a sense that I hope I've redeemed her reputation slightly in this book. As I say, she's been dismissed mostly by male literary critics and literary historians as nothing more than this wanton. And I've always felt there had to be much more about her than that. And I believe there is. And I hope this book brings it out.
Yeah, well, they certainly, I mean, you know, he kept going back to her, as you said. It was by choice. And even though they shared lovers, I mean, they shared more than Manet. Him and Manet shared a couple of different lovers, didn't they?
They absolutely did. I mean, the fact is she slept with most of his friends and he sort of accepted that. That was Paris at the time, I have to say, where it was probably more usual.
Right. Well, that period in Paris has often been referred to as the city's most prolific and decadent period. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. But I think the point is, Baudelaire grew up in the old medieval Paris of the 1830s and 40s. And in his time, as he grew older, Paris was completely transformed under Emperor Napoleon. And his main urban architect, Haussmann, destroyed, if you like, the old slums and created the City of Light that we know today with the broad boulevard and the tree-lined streets and the squares. And Baudelaire saw all that happening around him. And while he regretted the loss of the sort of the medieval past, he also rejoiced in the new, because Baudelaire was a very modern man. He was a forward-looking man. He understood that things change all the time. And that, again, is part of his contradictory sort of character. So he lived through the greatest period, if you like, in Paris's history, in terms both of the political changes, the mob and the barricades, and the creation of the modern Paris.
Right, absolutely. You know, people often say they'd love to get in a time machine and go into the future. I would go into history. I think it's fascinating. This is a
absolutely
fascinating story. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. Very well written and, you know, just a great read. Tell listeners what you'd like to know about the book before you leave us today.
What I'd like them to know, I would like them to know that this is a story, as I've said, of a great love affair. I think it's a story which takes us back to a time when a man of genius, Baudelaire, was creating not just great poetry, but art criticism and many other things. And that he was enabled to do so by an extraordinary woman, a woman who gave him something that he did not recognize in himself, but he reached out for in her. So, above all else, this is a love affair that was ruinous for both of them, that was highly destructive for both of them, but was, at the end of the day, helped create this astonishing work of art.
Yeah, and the Les Fleurs du Mal, he had six poems in there that I think were dedicated just to her, you said, right?
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, James McManus, pleasure talking with you again. I look forward to your next book coming out.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate
it. Not at all. Thank you.
And please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We will be right back.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Eric Maisel shares 9 ways to achieving your artistic goals. Maisel helps thousands of people follow their creative path and has written more than 40 books from psychology to making your creative mark. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. And check out conversationslive.net for more than 200 podcasts.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Linda Krill is my next guest. Her book is called Blind Curves. Let me tell you a little bit about Linda. This is a fascinating story, interesting journey. Linda is a sought-after Washington, D.C. area consultant and international speaker. She's worked with Citigroup, Cadbury's Mott's, Goldman Sachs, Marriott International, and many other Fortune 100 companies, universities, and also nonprofits. And in Blind Curves, she describes her unusual road to reinvention. But I'm going to bring her on, and we're going to share more about her background and her journey in her own words. Linda Krill, welcome.
Welcome to you, too. I'm glad to speak with you all.
So the book is called Blind Curves, One Woman's Unusual Journey to Reinvent Herself and Answer What Now? So before we get there, let's go back a little way. And before this journey, you were married, you were healthy, happy, successful. Unfortunately, your husband got sick and you lost him, as I understand, when you were 57. So talk to us a little bit about that next period, because, you know, people go through these experiences, and tell us a little bit about that experience.
You know, it's there are so many people who have lost someone that they love, and you know that there's a period of mourning that will be there afterwards. And since he had a terminal form of cancer that with no survivorship, we weren't surprised that he did not make it more than 11 months after being diagnosed. So I expected to mourn him, and I think American society teaches us that a year later we should be up and ready to go. At least that's what I thought, that I would be back into life. I would always miss him, always love him dearly. We had one of those very, very special marriages. But what I didn't know is that actually I not only had to mourn the loss of my husband, but I had to mourn the loss of the old Linda. She was no longer there. So many things that had made sense when he was alive didn't make sense when he wasn't there. The way I cooked was the way he liked to eat, because mm-hmm. he had Crohn's disease and couldn't eat spicy foods. And so I still, a year later, was cooking without onions or garlic. And there were so many aspects of our social life that I thought I was independent. I thought I was on my own. But I suddenly realized so many of those activities were dependent on the two of us for different phases of them. So I really had to reinvent myself.
Right. We do tend to, as you say, create this bubble around ourselves, you know, and who we are and where our life fits in the bigger scheme of things. When your husband died and you go through this period of mourning, and as you said, you know, everybody expects you to be up and jumping after 12 months and even sooner. But you were still feeling pretty cruddy, and you got to a point where you realized, you know, treading gently, being kind to myself, taking care of myself. Yes, I have to do this, but it's not working.
Right. 18 months after he had left. And the irony of it is that I was a managing change consultant. I worked with Fortune 100 companies on how to bring about change. And so I had tried all the things I would have used on my corporate customers to try to rebuild life. But when you're brainstorming about what to do next, and you're only coming out of this bubble of who you've been, and you don't know who you can become yet, all the ideas I would come up for with what I could do next weren't things that lit my fire. I couldn't passionately follow them. Mm-hmm. So I tried new things, but I was really disappointed. And I said to myself, at some point, you've got to do something completely different, because Einstein had the famous quote that a lot of us use that says, insanity is doing more of the same and expecting different results.
Right, right. And so at some point, you go to lunch with an old friend and you're telling him you know, you, I think you'd had a phone call with your brother and your sister and brother-in-law, and he'd said at the end of it, take care of yourself, and you kind of unloaded on him a little.
Well, it was amazing. We Americans love to give each other advice, and especially women love to give other women advice. And when they know you're not happy, everybody would tell me, make sure you're eating, sleeping, and getting plenty of exercise. And I would always look at everybody who said that to me and say, thank you, as if I hadn't been told it 8 times before that same evening. And I just thank them because nobody knows what to say to a widow. So I had been told this to death. So my poor brother-in-law, it's that Chinese water torture, is when he finally said it to me, I blew up at him and said, no way, no one has ever overachieved it following this advice, and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So I said, what's the most opposite thing I could think of? And in just a fit of rebellion, I threatened to learn to ride a motorcycle. And then next day, had lunch with a friend, and he said, how are you doing? And I said, it's not coming back together. In fact, I even threatened to learn to ride a motorcycle.
And then he says...
And then he says to me, he starts to laugh. He's a corporate executive heading a business. And he says to me, Linda, don't you know I organize motorcycle trips all over the world and groups of us fly to these foreign countries? And in 2 months, we're flying to Vancouver, Canada. We're going to do the coast on motorcycles, on Harleys. We're going to Victoria Island. Then we're going down Washington, Oregon, Northern California, through the wine country, back up through the middle of Washington State. Normally, there's 6 to 8 of us. This time, there's only 4. And the woman that was going with her husband, he can't go, and she can't go unless we can find a woman motorcycle rider. We need you.
Right. Now, had you even been on the back of a motorcycle at that point?
I think when I was maybe in high school, I rode the back of a motorcycle a couple of times. But to me, I was a bicyclist. I bicycle all the time, and I'm a tree hugger, and I'm a greenie. And so the idea of motorcycles were those noisy things that disturb everybody's peace. And to me, it was the last thing I thought I would ever do.
Right. So you did go to learn, you did take this journey, lots and lots and lots of lessons along the way. You know, I think the first lesson was you've actually failed your test, you said, and you had such a short time to prepare for this trip.
Well, it was I would never recommend anybody do what I've done. In fact, it's fun when I meet men that are very, very good motorcyclists, and they said, I couldn't have done this. But 30 days before the journey, because I waited 30 days before I decided to go for sure, I sat on a motorcycle for the first time. So I actually flew out and began this journey with less than 30 days of riding experience. And, yes, I did fail the Harley Learn to Ride 3-day course, and I failed the next 3 days at the DMV, trying to get my motorcycle license. It took me 4 tries before I finally passed. But that's where another very big surprise happened to me. We say pamper yourself, you know, take care of yourself. Actually, the day I passed that motorcycle exam on the 4th day was the happiest day I had since my husband had died.
Mm-hmm. I can believe that.
And we don't think about that, but when we go into something we think we can't do and we stick with it, and when we are finally given the reward of, yes, you've made it, the joy that comes at that moment, and this is the opposite of pampering, was actually finding out that I could trust Linda again. She could do something hard. She could fail, and she didn't crumble. Right. She stuck in there, and she could do it again. And this learning to trust ourselves after life has given us, and I don't mean just for widows. It happens to all of us at different phases of our life where we lose a job or our health has declined or something. When we find out we can trust ourselves again and we can trust ourselves to hang in there, there's a real feeling of elation that comes.
Yeah, and here's what I love about the fact that you did fail and you just kept retaking it till you passed is so many people would have said, oh, well, the universe is telling me this isn't meant to be.
Well, you know what I said? I said, I have stood on the gates of hell. This is not even close. In other words, I've seen someone suffering, you know, trying to cling on to life day by day. And the night I failed the test, I was very, very depressed, very downhearted. But the thing is, when I woke up the next morning, I said, you know, after all I've been through, this is just a silly motorcycle lesson. And if I fail it, I'll just go and rent a convertible and drive along with the people in a convertible behind them. I don't have to be on a motorcycle.
Right, right.
So I immediately thought of a plan B, and I kept a plan B. Even when I flew out there, the group and I had agreed that if I could not keep up, if it were too scary, if it were too difficult, I would just park the motorcycle and rent a car.
There you go.
Thank God. Of course, if you know my personality, hell would have to freeze over before I would willingly want to admit that. But
I believe that too.
Always when you're trying something new and that's out of your range of comfort, you have to know what are some backup plans.
Right. One of the things I picked up from the book, you said that on this journey, you very quickly learned, hey, I need to quit giving myself a daily report card.
That's true. We all somehow or another get so hungry for, did I do well enough? Did I achieve? And when you're learning something new, you know, whether it's a foreign language, whether it's learning accounting, whether it's learning to ride a bicycle or a motorcycle, there are some days that you just do not do well. And when we're sitting there trying to decide each day, am I doing well enough? We're really hard on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the journey. Part of learning, I mean, watching a two-year-old learning how to walk, how many times do they fall down? But each time they fall, you know, they have to learn something about, oh, that didn't work. And yes, you know, you're going to, if you do something extreme, that's challenging, you're going to fail.
I think that's so true. I think if you do look at children who are trying to learn to walk, as you said, or trying to fit something into a little hole that's never going to fit, there's such tenacity there. You can learn a lot from that.
Yes.
Another thing you said is that society and media glamorize youth, but along the journey, you really grew to appreciate maturity.
Yes. Well, the thing that I learned from the media, we think we know this country because we see so many people on TV and we reach out to so many different areas of the world. We think we're very sophisticated, but when you're wearing leather like I was on this trip and you're driving a big, huge motorcycle, and I was on a full-size Harley, people come up to you. And I was said that people would come up to me that normally in my regular world, I would have walked across the street to avoid because they would look so scary. And so here would come these heavily tattooed people and with long hair and wearing different clothes than I would normally associate with, and kids wearing all these tattoos and metal, and they would come over and talk to me, and we wouldn't just talk about motorcycling, we would talk about everyday things, and I went, oh my God, I thought I knew this country, I thought I was so sophisticated, but my world gets so much bigger when you start to realize that we've eliminated so much of our country from us. You know, if I'm here at the locally and going to the Starbucks and a person is standing in front of me that has a business suit on, I'd start a conversation.
Right.
Would I start a conversation if they were wearing metal? And would they start a conversation with me if I were wearing high heels and a business suit?
Right, right. Yeah, we base so much on appearances and that superficial glance. I liked what you said about this. I'm going to just read a little note I made here about something you said in the book. Horses sense fear or ineptitude. And it's the same with the bike, even though it's an inanimate object. And I can certainly relate to that because I've ridden both myself. But there's that feeling, you have to feel both of them. Talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Well, you know, when you're learning to ride a motorcycle, you have a clutch that you have to let out very slowly. And you have the right hand, the left hand is doing your clutch, and your right hand is doing the throttle for how much fast you go. And behind the throttle is your brake, believe it or not. You have to reach behind your gas pedal of such and grab a hold of the brake, and you have a foot brake. And there's so many things to remember. And it's so easy, if you start to feel at all like you're a stranger on this motorcycle, for you to let out the clutch too fast, or for you to rev it up and give it too much gas and suddenly leap forward when you're trying to start out, and or not to brake or overbrake. And so your attitude towards the bike, when you get more and more comfortable with it, by the eighth day, I no longer was thinking about braking. I just braked. And mm-hmm. You didn't know what the machine was, and you didn't know what Linda was. But at the initial part, if I were afraid of that machine, I treated it differently than when I finally reached over and I had a long conversation with it one day and said, come on, we're one. We have to operate as one. And I know this is the way I am with my bicycle. Is I don't know when I'm clutching or braking or not clutching, but braking or doing something on it. I just do it. I shift gears. I don't think about it. And the same thing happened with the motorcycle in me. And I said, by the end of the trip, it seems to be so wrong to have to walk across the parking lot and not be on two wheels.
Right.
It seems so inefficient. That yeah. You really get in tune with each other, and you really become, machine and man become one. And I know the same thing happens on horses or with a bicycle or with skis.
Yeah, it definitely does. And sailing for me too. Same thing. You're one with the boat and the wind and the water and all that. So that's going to lead me into my next question, because I want to talk about mindful meditation, which you talk about on the bike.
Yes.
But we want to take a quick break first, so we'll talk about that when we come back.
Thank you.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest is Linda Krill. Her book is called Blind Curves, One Woman's Unusual Journey to Reinvent Herself and Answer What Now. And I think she clearly answered what now. So please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
I didn't think it was anything.
I had pain in my abdomen. It just wouldn't go away.
I was spotting, but I had already gone through menopause.
These symptoms may be nothing, but they could be early warning signs of a gynecologic cancer, such as cervical, ovarian, or uterine cancer.
Seeing my doctor probably saved my life.
Warning signs are not the same for everyone. If you think something's wrong, see your doctor. Ask about gynecologic cancer. Call 1-800-CDC-INFO for more information. A message from the Inside Knowledge Campaign and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of animals. This week, May 19th, it's the third Sunday of the month, and that means it's a Kevin and Kim Sunday. Always entertaining, Kevin McDonald and Kim Miller, medium and animal intuitive, will host the show for me. They'll have open phone lines for calls, and Kim will help you connect with your animal or human loved ones on this side or the other. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I'm very pleased to have Linda Krill as my guest in this segment. Loved her story. She's a former executive entrepreneur. She's a speaker and consultant in the Washington, D.C. area, international speaker. And at the age of 57, lost her husband. And your whole life gets turned upside down at that point. 18 months into her widow journey, she decides, this is not working for me. I need to really do something radical. And Blind Curves, her book, is the result of that. Well, you're talking about the motorcycle journey. You took 2,500 miles down the Pacific coast. And before the break, we were talking about how you have to become one with a motorbike. They're such heavy things. You know, my brother, his kids have said, oh, his daddy's going through a midlife crisis because he bought himself a big motorbike a couple of years ago. He used to have one when he was younger and hadn't had one for 20 years. So he gets this big bike. He goes off to Europe through five countries. And when he was up in the Swiss Alps, he was just parking his bike because he's a photographer. So he's stopping often to take photos, parking his bike, and it slipped underneath him and it dropped and he could not pick it up. And I mean, he works out every day. He's 6 foot
right.
two. He just couldn't pick this up in the snow. So, and I know you've had an experience like that too.
Right. People don't realize that the motorcycles are anywhere from 400 pounds to 800 or so. And then, of course, being a woman, I put another 50 pounds worth of luggage on the back of it. And most of us do have, you know, when it's laden down with even more. And so one of the things I didn't think about when I learned to ride this was the fact that I would actually have to balance an 800-pound machine. And if it gets a little bit off balance, it starts to fall over. You're not going to, most of us aren't strong enough to pick it back up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called dropping a bike, which is different than crashing. But everybody drops a bike. or motorcycle when they're learning to ride it at some point, especially when you're going slow in a parking lot and suddenly someone starts to pull out or there's a pothole and you can't dodge it and a dog's barking at you or something, you go over.
Yeah. So we were talking as well before the break about this, being at one with your bike, and mindful meditation is what I want to talk about now, because I had the conversation with my brother who said the same thing. You do, and I do on a road trip in a car, but I would imagine it's different, even better on a bike. You go into this mindful meditation where, yes, you're paying attention, but you're also in a meditative state. Talk to us a little bit about that, Linda, and how that helps you through that process.
Yeah, I do mindful meditation on my own, and to me, mindfulness just means coming to the absolute present moment. And when you do mindful meditation off the bicycle or anyplace else, it just, your mind will want to run to the future, it will run to the past. You sit there and analyze. In fact, psychologists estimate that 85% of all of our thoughts are thoughts we've had before. And what mindfulness just means is coming to the present moment and learning to be and quit doing. And when you're on a motorcycle, you have to be, you're invisible to all the other vehicles around you a lot of the time. And so you have to constantly be thinking, where is every car, where is every truck? And be very aware of where people are, because they may not see you in their rearview mirrors. They're not looking for something on two wheels. They're looking for something on four wheels. And we all know how often in a car somebody will start to pull out and not see us in the left lane. So you're very conscious of that. But like when you come to a stop sign, I sit there and watch, and most of us do watch in our rearview mirrors to make sure the car behind us stops. And I automatically know that I'm going to go right around the car in front of me or left if he doesn't stop or she doesn't stop. So you're constantly doing this. And you're looking at the road because you're on two wheels for what are cracks? Are there stones? Are there liquids that might have fallen off of a, dropped out of a car that will make something slippery? And so all the times you have to stay current in that present moment. You can't do like I do when I'm in my car and let my mind drift off every other place. You're sitting there watching the road because, a pipe that might have fallen off of a pickup truck can kill you. And so you're constantly watching the road. You're constantly watching the environment around you. And so one of the things that most of us notice is that keeps us in the current moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is a form of meditation. I think this kind of current moment happens. We've often heard being in the zone when we talk about it, like in dancing or basketball or in sometimes even when we're writing or working. Being in the zone to me is the same thing as mindfulness.
Yes, I would agree. Yeah. My grandfather used to have a saying when we were kids. He'd say, climb out of your head, go climb a tree. similar kind of thing is what he meant.
Yes.
So what did you learn about Linda? How did Linda change? How did you change on that journey? What did you learn about yourself?
Well, one of the big things I learned was that I need to erase this boundary that I drew around myself in pretty heavy ink. There's so much stimulation coming at us in this world between the news and the media and that you should do this, you should do that. Our time is taken away from us. We create around ourselves, here are my friends, here are the things I like, here's the things I do, here's the things I don't like. And what I learned in this journey was you have to continuously erase those boundaries. And all those things I said I'd never do, all those things I said I don't like, I don't want, I don't become, are fine because they're filters that keep me from becoming overwhelmed. But I have to continuously look at those. And ever since I've gone on this motorcycle trip, I keep erasing more and more of those things that I said I would never do.
And
it's very freeing.
Yes, it is very freeing. And the freer you become, the more you want to go out and embrace new things.
Well, I keep saying, the reason I call this book Blind Curves is usually, I was ready to go and try anything different because more of the same wasn't okay. And that's why I call it a blind curve. You don't know whether what's around this curve is going to be better, but at least you know it's going to be different. And sometimes I've been in a job that has been non-ending and I've not been happy, and you're willing to resign and go to the next thing because not that the next job is going to be better. You're just tired of that set of problems. And to me, blind curve living is just to say I constantly have to be looking and trying something new. And, we get left behind so fast in this world that constantly making more and more territory that I'm comfortable in is so much better as far as coming up with new ideas and how to live.
Right. What was the most challenging time for you? You had some scary moments, but what was the most challenging for you?
had a long, hard day on the, we had only one day that we were on the interstate the whole day, and we had passed a motorcycle accident, and that's very, very humbling when you're riding by that, and you have no idea what happened to it. And the sun was 100 degrees, and we were stuck on the California freeway doing beep and bump, and a beep and bump on a motorcycle for 3 hours in 100 degrees sun was just killing. And by the time we finally got to the end of that day, and we thought we were at Crater Lake, and we thought we would finally be able just to put up our feet and relax. We had driven 14 or 15 hours that day. We got into the place, and she said to us at the national park, "I'm sorry, but the roads have ice on them, and there's hairpin turns, and it's going to be very challenging." And we just looked at each other and said, "Oh, my God." We thought we had given every bit of energy just to get to the destination, and now we find out we have one more thing to do. And as we went up the hill, that mountain that night with, you know, black ice on the roads and with hairpin turns, we kept waiting for these terrible, terrible, terrible conditions to be there. But we just stood, I said, the whole journey was too hard. The next 10 yards was not. So you concentrate on the next 10 yards and the next 10 yards and the next 10 yards. And we got up to the top of the mountain, and there the Crater Lake Lodge was. And we were shocked. We were still waiting for those terrible, terrible turns. And we'd actually driven right through them.
Yeah, amazing, chunking it down as we do in at work, you know.
Yes, that's true a lot. And so all of these lessons that I learned or relearned, these aren't great secrets. These are, I'm sure as your listeners are listening, they say, yeah, I know these things. It's just when you have them brought to you all in a succession of 10 days, it really was what I needed to say. I can go back out there. I can go through blind curves. I can go up snowy mountains. I can go up gravel roads. I can do all sorts of things I thought I couldn't do.
Right. It is remembering those things, as you say, during those times. And overcoming what you call the imposter syndrome, because so many people do feel if they make change, they say, I've heard people say it, I feel like an imposter. I did when I first left the financial world many years ago and started writing. I feel like an imposter, you know, and then all of a sudden.
But the imposter piece is we say in our society, fake it until we make it, but they don't say how you feel while you're faking it. And it turns out that when you talk to other people, I told people the first night of writing that, oh my God, don't call me brave. I'm anything but brave. I'm scared to death. And they all looked at me and said, we were scared too. It's new motorcycles, it's new roads, it's new conditions. We assume our emotions are the only ones that are feeling this insecure. We can walk into a conference or a meeting or a place and say, look, everybody else here, the singles dance is so relaxed. And yet, when you really talk to them, you're going to find out that almost everybody is reflecting your own insecurities.
Right. And we're right at the end of our segment now, but I want to just read a couple of lines from the book. They're in separate paragraphs, but I'm just going to piece this together because I have to shorten it. You say, before the trip, I'd been sitting in the middle of my own serene scene, waiting for the right answers to come and tell me what to do next to recreate my life as a single woman. Now I knew what I needed to do instead of waiting for those winning answers to come to me was to create fuel to birth them. I think that's great. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Linda?
I just think all of us have this bit of motorcyclist in us, and I think we just have to be encouraged to say, what have I been putting off, and to go and embrace it.
Yeah. And listeners can find out more about you at which website?
Linda Krill, that's CRILL.com, or if you forget that, blindcurves.com.
Okay. Linda Krill, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Vicki.
Loved your story.
Thank you.
And again, the book is called Blind Curves, One Woman's Unusual Journey to Reinvent Herself and Answer What Now? And my guest, Linda Krill, you can find her at lindakrill.com or blindcurves.com. And I should also mention James. I forgot to mention James' website when we signed off with him, and that is jamesmcmanus.com, jamesmcmanus.com, of course, who wrote Black Venus. And I want to thank you for being with us today. I appreciate you spending this hour with us. If you've got questions or comments or feedback on today's show, you can reach me a number of different ways. You can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or info@conversationslive.net, and conversations is plural. And you can also catch today's podcast. It'll be up by the end of day tomorrow at the latest at conversationslive.net. And you can also find me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair. And I should spell my name. My friend said, you need to spell your name, but it usually pops up even if you misspell it. It's V-I-C-K-I VickySaintClair. Did I get that right? It's Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Thanks so much for being with us. Next week, we're going to talk about creativity. A lot of people think they can't make a living doing what they love. But I know Eric Maisel, we've talked with him a couple of times before, and he's got a new book out calling Nine Waves Nine Ways to Achieving Your Artistic Goals. And he knows what he's talking about because he's made a very good living at doing this. He's going to join us next week. And I hope you all have a great week. Until next week, live well, live strong. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Eric Maisel shares 9 ways to achieving your artistic goals. Maisel helps thousands of people follow their creative path and has written more than 40 books from psychology to making your creative mark. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. And check out conversationslive.net for more than 200 podcasts.